This conference will.
This is the first call of the It's Emotional Abuse, Don't Try to Fix It teleprogram. And tonight we're going to be talking about the abusive man and specifically understanding the abusive man. Because the problem that most women have is they don't understand who they're dealing with. We all start from the premise that he must have the same kind of values as I do and want the same kind of things as I do and have the same kind of morality as I do. And it's not true. Abusive men operate very, very differently. So that's what we're going to be talking about tonight. And the starting point has to be that when you first meet an abusive man and fall in love with him, you don't realize he's abusive. It goes without saying that there will be that split second, that very first impression, when a little voice in your head says to you, bad news, steer clear of this man, or I really don't like him, or something like that. And you disregard that little voice of intuition, the quiet voice of self-preservation. There will be reasons why you pay no attention to that voice of intuition. It might happen because of your hunger for a relationship. It could be that he looks good and sounds good, although not good enough to fool your intuition for a moment. The fact that he's expressed a strong interest in you may be enough to seduce you if you're feeling needy and unlovable. Your conscious mind generally has no idea how badly the relationship will turn out. Your conscious mind doesn't look beyond what it wants. Finally, the relationship you hunger for with a man who will love and care for you. So the reality doesn't quite fit with your dream. The man standing in front of you falls short of perfect in some ways that may be slightly worrying, but hey, that's all right. You're willing to compromise here and there, provided you get the essence of what you want. You're used to settling for less, aren't you? You play out delightful future fantasies in your head. You don't play out possible nightmares. When you have a relationship with this man, the fears and the anxieties, even the nightmares, will all be behind you, right? There are some very good reasons why we don't understand who we are getting involved with when we enter into a relationship with an abusive man. The first has to be the pile of our own baggage that we're carting around. The feelings of being unlovable and unworthy that we'll be looking at next week. The second reason is that in most cases, an abusive man presents as more or less desirable. He looks like a desirable relationship prospect. Not that that's always the case, though. I worked with one client who told me that her abusive partner stood her up on the first date. Friends had warned her that he was a player and a drinker, but he was attractive and fun, so she agreed to go on a first date with him. When he stood her up, she called him to say that she didn't expect to be treated that way, which sounds reasonable, but it turned out to be extremely unwise. You see, that call just played into his hands. He had a fantastic way of dealing with it that she wasn't expecting that completely threw her. He answered her call, and instead of apologizing or justifying himself, he launched a major verbal assault on her. He told her he would not tolerate women calling to tell him off. He made a few very hurtful remarks about her, and you know what? By the time she got off that call, she had agreed to another date with him. For all that, she had no idea how destructive that relationship would be because she was so focused on being with someone who was attractive, fun, and sexy. Clearly she'd missed something. But most of us do. Most of us don't get such a clear warning as she did before she even got into the relationship. Most of us watch our abusive partner's abusive tendencies unfurl over time. If we and he are quite young, it may be the first time that he really discovers his voice as an abuser. So before we focus on the behaviors of an abusive man, I want to spend a little time talking to you about their formation and thinking, purely for your own information. Not because that knowledge would help you to heal them. I don't believe it would. Besides, everybody's healing is their own responsibility. And it is only by healing ourselves that we have any hope of being a catalyst for the healing of others. I'm just sharing this with you so that you have some more insight and understanding. I've been working for a while with a young man who is quite delightful. He is bright, attractive, that never harms, and responsive. Since he started working with me, he has made many, many positive changes in his life. I can't deny that that makes me feel good. He had a very tough childhood with an alcoholic, abusive father and almost no money coming into the family home. He became incredibly self-reliant at a very young age and he spent a lot of years as a workaholic. In fact, that's why he came to see me in the first place. In due course, he mentioned specific issues in his marriage that were troubling him. He has said on many occasions that he loves his wife to pieces. I've spoken with the two of them on several occasions, and I've been shocked to discover that this young man, who I regard so highly, is on the cusp of becoming a fully-fledged abuser. He started to use a range of abusive behaviors with his wife, including spitting, pushing, sulking for days at a time, and being verbally and emotionally threatening. At times, his fury with his wife is quite intimidating. How does that happen with this woman that he says he loves to pieces? This is the point of the story. Simon, not his real name, grew up with a father who always found fault with him and always punished him brutally for anything and everything. Simon hates his father passionately, and he has good reason to do so. He's done everything he possibly could to break free from the life he knew as a child and build something better for himself. But sadly, he's still living with his father's blueprint. His inner world, Simon's inner world, is still one in which he is treated as worthless and his feelings are utterly disregarded. Actually, he does pretty well in the outside world. He's very socially engaging. He is, not surprisingly, a bit of a people pleaser. But it's obvious when you think about it. He learned that he had to please his father at all times or the consequences would be awful. He learned that he could never afford to get anything wrong. To the outside world, Simon is a popular guy with a big circle of friends who would never believe how disadvantaged he feels by comparison with them. But he projects in one way and experiences himself in another. Inside his own head, he feels disadvantaged in every way. He feels he's come from the wrong side of the tracks and has no education. He fears that one day his friends will find him out and won't want to know him because they're better than he is. Significantly, what he worries they may find out one day has nothing to do with the way he treats his wife, but only where he comes from and what he believes he's worth. A little while back, Simon and his wife told me about a major fight they had had about a collection of shoeboxes in their hall. A couple of his friends were coming over to their apartment, and he asked his wife, "Are you happy about those shoeboxes in the hall?" Now, she thought the question was simply a query. The shoeboxes didn't worry her, and so she said that she didn't have a problem with them. That became a fight that has gone on for over a month now. Why? Well, first, let's deal with the wife's side. Her husband asked her question about shoeboxes, and she thought the issue was about shoeboxes. She didn't have an issue with where the shoeboxes were, not that she would have minded moving them, but she hadn't picked up that this question was a minefield that she walked straight into. What made it a minefield? For Simon, having the shoeboxes in the hall when his friends came round meant that, in his eyes, his home looked like a slum, the kind of slum, in fact, he'd grown up in. So having those shoeboxes in his hallway diminished him massively in his own eyes. Then his wife missed the importance of the question for him. For him, that meant she hadn't listened to anything that he had said to her in all the years they'd been together. It meant that she didn't love him. It meant, therefore, that all the time and energy he had put into loving her had been wasted. It meant that he had thrown his life away trying to please some heartless bitch. Now, certainly this is a huge leap and a nonsensical leap, but inside his head it was no leap. It was the logical meaning of her unconcern, as he saw it. So he felt totally unloved and disrespected, and that fed into all his childhood feelings of being unloved. But there was also more. Because he had lived in fear of his father's fury and violence, Simon still, in his own eyes, spent his life walking on eggshells. As he saw it, he spent his whole time doing everything he possibly could to please his wife, and this was the way she repaid him. As he told it, he obsessed about everything he did, where he placed anything in their apartment, for fear of upsetting her. While she, with one careless remark about the shoeboxes, had smashed him into the ground psychologically. Was this true? Was he factually accurate that he kept their apartment perfectly tidy and did everything he possibly could for his wife? I very much doubt it. The point is, that was how he felt at the time. His wounds were so raw and immediate that it took only a small thing to trigger immense reservoirs of anger, hurt, and frustration. As a child, he clearly could not manage those feelings, and his options were limited. He had become good at second-guessing his father's feelings, although never good enough because he still got hit. He had to do everything he could not to upset his father in any way, and he had to learn how to keep as low a profile as possible. When Simon's wife did something, or more correctly, fell into a trap that triggered his feelings, he stopped seeing her as the wife he loved. Now, this is something he didn't say at all. He wasn't even aware of it. When he was angry with her, he referred to her again and again as somebody. He did not even use her name once when speaking about her. That reminded me of something I'd heard about the way the Nazis referred to Jews in the concentration camps. They called them shades. That kind of thinking allows the thinker to completely depersonalize the other person. When they have stripped that person of their identity, it becomes easy to treat them brutally. In short, Simon is still battling with unresolved feelings from the past. And because he didn't know how to process his difficult emotions, it's easier to project them onto his wife and then punish her for them. He feels very, very sorry for himself. When he's in that mode, he honestly feels that he is the victim of a callous, demanding, selfish bitch. At this point in their relationship, he believes he truly loves his wife, and he believes that he has to attack her to defend himself from the hurt that she is causing him by treating him so badly. He honestly believes that. He also believes that if he makes a big enough fight of it and hurts her enough, she will have to learn the lesson and be more accommodating to him. And much as he loves her and says he loves her, he is more intent on getting her to see things exactly the way that he does than he is on preserving what's good about their relationship. The irony of it is that she truly loves him, and she has supported him every which way over a period of years. But when his old hurts and fury are triggered, he doesn't see it. All he can see is his father in front of his eyes in feminine form. Now, I've gone into Simon's story in some detail because I'm guessing we've all been on the receiving end of something similar. I know that I was, and I know that I could not begin to make sense of it because it was far, far too painful. It also conflicted with my view of reality. But here's the thing, Abuse World, which we'll talk about at length in week 3, is a crazy place. When Simon gets himself into that state, he really believes the things he says, which means that there is no possible dialogue with his wife. And in order to guarantee there is no dialogue, he makes an art form of shouting his wife down. He can be very good at verbal intimidation. One final note on Simon. He refers to his father as demonic and says that he wants nothing to do with him. He doesn't even want to think about him. Yet his father's behavior is quickly triggered in his brain, and then he acts out as his father. When Simon goes into mini-me, which I'll say more about at another point, he reacts by becoming his father. Now, when you listen to all of this, does it make you realize why you cannot help and certainly cannot change an abusive partner? In his own mind, your abusive partner sees himself as the victim and you as the perpetrator. He has a mountain of his own baggage, and rather than work through it, he will dump it on you. And he is not prepared to put you and the relationship above his need to punish you into submission. What he wants from you is, of course, utterly unrealistic. He wants you to be so perfect that you will never press his buttons, and he is living with a volcano of past hurts and self-pity. He feeds those feelings of hurt and self-pity all the time. Everything you do that falls short of perfection feeds his feelings. No wonder he explodes. One thing I forgot to mention about Simon is that when the lava level is high enough and it finally spews out, the thing that he wants is space. He wants his wife to give him the space to calm down. So he withdraws from her. He stops speaking to her. Once again, he is dumping onto her the responsibility for managing his emotions. It's his job to create that emotional space for himself internally. The bottom line is that you cannot heal an abusive partner. God knows you've tried, as I did, because your abusive partner needs you to be, in his mind, the perpetrator. He has to want to get beyond that and commit to his own feeling for things to change. And in most cases, it's never going to happen. He is more committed to feeling those feelings of hurt and anger and even injustice than he is to you. Like you, he has experienced a poor model of love when he was growing up. He's also learned that women, including you, have failed him. Where in all of that did you hear one word of compassion or love for the object of his fury, that is, you? There isn't one. At best, you'll hear the kind of thing my husband said to his psychotherapist when he's in good boy mood, which went like this. I love Anne very much, but she is this, that, and the other, which makes the relationship intolerable. He would sound calm and controlled because he intended to impress on the therapist that he was the good partner. But his use of the word but was the key. The thing that really mattered was getting his point of view to win out about how the relationship should run and on whose terms. In the case of Simon, and quite possibly in the case of many abusive men, including my own husband, they go into the relationship believing they can offer love and looking for a woman so perfect that she'll spare them the trouble of having to deal with their own difficult feelings. That woman doesn't exist, of course. It isn't you. It wasn't me. The crazy thing is that we thought we might be able to be that woman if we tried hard enough. But it was never going to happen because it required that we and our abusive partner overlook the volcano of negative feelings that he brought to the relationship. He didn't want a flesh and blood woman with her own human frailties and her strengths. What he wanted was essentially a Stepford wife. Remember, he was by his very nature programmed to explode at regular intervals. Quite possibly, if you review your relationship, you'll see that your abuser really did explode at regular intervals. Once we were married, my husband settled into a 6-weekly cycle. Over the years, it reduced considerably until he could go round the whole thing in 5 to 7 days. So, the need for love may well be real at the start, but there is another need that with time, and usually not very much time, outweighs the love, and that is the need for power and control over you. Your abuser needs to have power over you in order to make himself feel powerful. Love may be the big buzz for you. That's normal. Power and control is a more urgent need for him. A little while back, I came across a book called The Dominator by Pat Craven. And I have actually recorded an interview with Pat Craven, which I have offered to my list, so you may have come across it. Craven works with abusive men, and she has an interesting and enlightened way of describing abusive men. She breaks down the abuser personality into 8 different categories, most or all of whom you already know. And I'm going to spend some time running through them now. Number 1 is the bully. This is the man who glares, snarls, shouts, smashes things, and sulks. The bully is brilliant at intimidating his partner. He uses a number of techniques to ensure that you never feel safe. Say you're out at a party and he's a relatively civilized abuser.
Please leave your name and phone number and we will return a call to you as soon as possible. Thank you.
Hi, I've got no idea what that is. So, say you're out at a party and he's a relatively civilized abuser. He may choose not to have the fight with you then and there. That could ruin his public credibility. His Mr. Nice Guy image, assuming that he has one. Instead, he can just turn away from the group towards you, change his tone of voice and say, "We'll talk about this later." Or maybe he'll simply turn that facial expression on you, the one that tells you that he's going to make your life very painful later. And then he'll turn back to the group and be charm personified. By now, your evening is ruined, of course, because you have a good idea of what is coming later. You can't avoid it, you can't laugh him out of it, and the anticipation only adds to your anxiety. The bully is a very, very angry persona. But here's the thing. Listen to what Craven says. She says, "The men on my program have told me that the bully is not angry. He is cool, calm, and collected, and completely in control of his emotions. What does he have to be angry about?" Think about it for a moment. Does that make sense to you? It certainly did to me. One of the very last times I ever saw my ex-husband was when our paths crossed in a gas station. I had my daughter with me. She'd refused to see her father for some time because he had visited his anger on her also. This encounter that we had would have lasted all of about 1 minute, if that. My daughter and I were walking up to the teller as my ex-husband was walking away from the teller towards his car. So he had to walk straight past us. And as he came towards us, first, his eyes rested on me, pardon me, and he gave me that look. His face reddened, fury and hatred were written all over it. And then he turned his gaze onto our daughter. The redness drained from his forehead. The eyebrows lifted. The eyes widened. I noticed how the corners of his mouth lifted into a smile. It was an extraordinary process. It really was like watching one mask mutate into another. It was immensely validating to me to learn from Pat Craven that abusive men can make themselves red in the face. So persona number 1, the bully. persona number two, the jailer. The jailer is obviously the persona that robs you of your freedom. He may stop you working. He may object to your friends and make it impossible for you to see them. He may do this openly or sneakily. My husband tried ordering me not to see my friends and realized that he was on to a non-starter. So he used other tactics instead. Because at the time I was very insecure and trusted in his judgment, when I asked him what he thought of my friends, he would often be very negative. He'd tell me they were not true friends, or that they were only interested in themselves, or some such claptrap. Often I bought it. The other technique he used to great effect was being so stunningly offensive to them as to destroy the friendship. Since we socialized primarily as a couple, if friends did not want to see him again, it meant that I did not see them either. However, he did encourage friendships with people who were too naive to see through him. We had a few rather dull and not terribly bright friends who idolized the good doctor. That worked for him. Most jailers will also do everything they can to isolate you from your family in the normal way, because your family care about your best interests. Not every family does, but most do. Your family are therefore a threat to the jailer's control over you. They're rivals who must be taken off the scene. If, however, you come from a very abusive family and your partner and your family both treat you as a worthless waste of space, then he'll be able to have a very good relationship with them. They will all have a shared interest in humiliating you and keeping you down. The jailer may well tell you what to wear and how to behave. He may check the mileage on your car and phone you throughout the day to check up on you. If he ever cares for the children you have together, he may make a point of doing it so badly that in the interest of the children, you don't feel you can ever ask him to do so again. I remember once my husband was taking my daughter to school. He managed to get her out of the house and into the car with just one shoe on. And I got the message that I could never rely on him to care adequately for her most basic needs. The jailer may encourage you not to work because he will look after you. He may be abusive to your work colleagues and managers. He may create rows when you have to work late. He may wipe your assignments off the computer. The jailer finds ways to sabotage you at every turn. And of course, when he holds the purse strings of the family money, that is another very powerful way of keeping you in prison. Persona number three is the head worker. And that's someone you all know really well, and not just the term. The head worker is the guy who puts you down and tells you that you're too fat, too ugly, too old, too stupid, too unlovable. He may make you the butt of his jokes in public. I remember my husband cracking jokes to a couple we were good friends with about how he couldn't even get me to iron his shirts properly. The other couple laughed, and so did I. What else could I have done? If I'd reacted, I'd have looked hysterical. And if I had further irritated my abuser, he would have punished me still further when we got home. So I sat with a smile on my face, pretending it was a joke and feeling absolutely humiliated and worthless. The head worker's task is to make you feel utterly worthless. His technique is brainwashing. He says the same things to you over and over again until you say them to yourself. When he does his job right, and believe me, he does, you don't even need him around. You will still keep telling yourself the same things that he told you. What's worse, you'll believe that they're absolutely true. And that can be why it's so hard to get away from him even after you've left him. Get away from him in your own head, that is. As a general principle, if the head worker says something, it most probably isn't true. He says it to hurt and diminish you. Other tricks the head worker will use are outright lies. He'll say something or do something and deny he ever did it. He will tell us that we did something that we did not do. One time my husband told me that I had nearly blinded my daughter. It was the end of a long, long day. I was tired and the hand I moved towards my daughter had a small knife in it, but it was way, way short of her face. Still, he went on and on about how I had nearly blinded my daughter until I believed that I was a totally unfit mother. That's how the head worker operates. He wants you to believe that you're mad as well as worthless. That means that he can be the beacon of truth and virtue. Persona number four, the persuader. The persuader is the one who cries, threatens, and cajoles. He may threaten to hurt or kill you or the children or the family pet, and you have to take those threats seriously. Whether or not he actually means it at the time, the threat is real. He may attempt to do so at some future date. The persuader also says he loves you and can't live without you, particularly when you've told him that you can't bear to be around him anymore. He may threaten to kill himself, and there's always an outside possibility that he may kill himself. When I left my abusive husband, his therapist, who I later found out was also an abusive man, told me that my husband was a suicide risk. Of course, that scared the hell out of me. I didn't want that on my conscience, and I certainly didn't want my daughter to have the legacy of a father who had committed suicide. But I couldn't let that influence my decision. Had he done that, that would have been his own choice. The bottom line, I decided, was this. If this man chose to take his own life, and I didn't think he would, but it was an outside possibility, then that was his decision. He was an adult man. He would have been responsible for his choice. When I felt suicidal, do you think that he was concerned? Of course he wasn't. In a healthy relationship, your partner's distress is something that should concern you. In an abusive relationship, one of you, usually the abused wife, is likely to experience a massive level of distress. That works well for the persuader. But if you look like you're going to break away from the relationship, that is very worrying for a persuader. It upsets the status quo. He'll threaten, plead, and cajole. If you weaken because the persuader tells you he might commit suicide, you will destroy your own life. You cannot know whether he truly intended to harm himself, although my guess is that he probably wouldn't. But getting almost to the point of leaving and then giving in will destroy or come very close to destroying you. That much is absolutely certain. The head worker is also the persona who will threaten to report you to the social services and let the authorities know you're an unfit mother or whatever else he feels he can use against you, such as alcohol consumption. Persona number five, the liar. The liar is the guy who kicks in halfway round the cycle of abuse. After he has had his abusive outburst and realized he's gone too far, he'll go into regret mode and be Mr. Nice Guy for a while, as much as he can. There's usually something a bit icky about this, but hey, it's such a relief to feel you matter that you're relatively content to have Mr. Nice Guy in front of you. But here's the thing. If it feels good for you, it feels increasingly lousy for him. Being nice to you is not his thing. It makes him feel less worthy, so he starts to lose the sense of his own authority and status in the relationship. That's when the liar comes in. The liar minimizes the importance of what happened. The liar didn't push you down the stairs. It just gave you a playful tap and you fell. The liar didn't hit you hard. It was just a gentle slap. The liar didn't really say anything that was hurtful. It's just that you're being too sensitive. The liar blames it on you for making a big thing out of something that wasn't that important. Or he might blame it on the drink or the drugs. Or he could blame it on overwork or stress or unemployment or anything really. You get the picture. The liar is not in control of his response. He is merely a victim of you, of his past, of his present, or his habit. Persona number 6. The bad father. The bad father is a persona that really plays with his partner's head. One of his principal lines is that you are a bad mother. He knows exactly how much your kids matter to you, and he knows the lengths that you go to protect them from the ugly reality of your relationship. Not that you can. Children always sense it, even if they cannot see it. They are always affected. But within the crazy confines of an abusive relationship, you really are trying to protect your kids and make sure they're not affected. Not so the bad father. He'll do whatever he can to set your children against you. He'll talk badly about you to them. He'll collude with them against you. There are simple passive-aggressive ways of doing that, which look almost like indulgence. He may do the household chores you set for them. He may allow them to watch the television programs that you don't approve of. These are relatively simple ways of getting them on side and making you look bad. But the bad father won't stop there. He may go so far as to encourage them in destructive ways. That can include giving them too much money and freedom when they're too young and immature to handle it. It can mean giving them the money for drugs. The bad father does not care about his children's well-being. He is happy to use them as a tool to hurt their mother. Children are, after all, probably the most important weapon he has at his disposal. Persona number 7, the King of the Castle. The King of the Castle does not believe in equality. He's a tyrannical ruler. He treats you as his servant or slave. He expects everything to be done for him to his satisfaction. His meals will be ready on time. The peas must not touch the potatoes on his plate, if that's what he decides. His household must run in a certain way. His children and animals must behave the way he wants them to. He believes that women are for sex, cooking, and housework. If he ever does any cooking or housework, he tells you what he has done for you. It's an act of generosity, and you're meant to thank him for it. There is no sense that you share a life, and therefore it is normal to do things for each other without expecting undying gratitude for it. There are occasional kings of the castle who refuse to let you do anything because you are so useless you can't even do the cooking and cleaning properly. His thoughts, words, and opinion are important. Yours are not. The king of the castle controls the money, even if you have your own money, and he still expects to have the final say on how it's spent. He may regard himself as being better with the money than you are. For the king of the castle, having control of the purse strings at all times is an important measure of his power. The king of the castle expects sex on demand. For him, that is one of the terms of the relationship contract. And persona number 8, the sexual controller. The sexual controller uses sex to control us. In The Dominator, Craven says, he tells us it is our duty, and if we don't want sex, then we don't love him. He tells us we are hurting his feelings and makes us feel guilty. He tells us we must be frigid or a lesbian. He tells us sex is a medical necessity, and without it, his testicles will explode all over the carpet. He may use bribery and give us money for having sex with him. He will use intimidation, the threat of emotional and or physical violence to persuade us to have sex with him. He may threaten to go elsewhere if we do not satisfy his need. And the sexual controller has no qualms about rape. He will force you to have sex against your will. He will jump on you when you're asleep. He will say and do things to hurt and humiliate you deeply. And then he may become tender and loving after he's upset you sufficiently. You can end up associating the pain of attack with the pleasure of lovemaking. It is always the sexual controller who decides if and when you have sex. Craven says, if we make advances to him, he rejects us. He makes us feel like a whore for initiating sex. He starts to have sex with us, then stops abruptly, telling us he cannot continue and it is all our fault. He reluctantly has sex with us and either does not ejaculate or ejaculates prematurely. He then blames us for this. According to Craven, the sexual controller uses sex to degrade and destroy us. He certainly does not engage in lovemaking to celebrate love and intimacy. For the sexual controller, sex is not a celebration of love, but an expression of his power and control over us. Now, there are 8 personas there, and clearly there is a degree of overlap in these. One feeds naturally into another or several others. But I find that it's an interesting way to look at the abuser, especially for women who say, but he's got so much potential. Sure, there are times when he can be charming and engaging and endearing. You're not an idiot. You'd never have fallen for somebody who had nothing, absolutely nothing to recommend him. But he also has massive potential to hurt and humiliate you. And most of the time he uses it. He uses it because the need to do so is ingrained within him. Most probably because he has been taught to do so by another abuser. That's his heritage to deal with. We'll be looking at yours next week. The purpose of this class is to get you to understand more clearly what an abuser does, why he does it, and why it's not going to change just because you love him and you hope it will change. The bottom line is that abusive men simply do not like or value women. Their belief is that it is totally acceptable to treat women badly. The bully, the jailer, the head worker, the persuader, the liar, the bad father, the king of the castle, and the sexual controller all have contempt for the women who love them. Abusive men tend to be insecure, have low self-esteem, and have had a difficult childhood, and so on and so forth. That may be an accurate explanation, but it is not a justification for their behavior. There are plenty of men from difficult backgrounds who have grown up not to be abusers. Nor does it explain why some men from apparently quite privileged backgrounds grow up to be abusers. Rather, as Craven says, the real reason for their violence and abuse is their desire to keep women under control. Everything your abusive partner and mine ever did was ultimately about keeping you under their control. I'd like to end with a story I heard a few weeks ago from a domestic violence survivor. She's been away from her abusive husband for some years now. She's worked at her healing. She's no longer young, but she's still looking for a loving, fulfilling relationship. Recently, she bumped into someone she had long felt had potential to be the partner she was looking for. She hadn't seen him for a while. He was delighted to see her and told her how well she was looking. He said she was looking even younger than ever. He asked her to join him for a coffee then and there. She couldn't because she had a job to finish. As they parted, he looked at her fingernails and said, "Don't you think you're too old to be wearing that color?" When we deconstructed the exchange, what did we see? In the space of a couple of minutes, he did charm, or the promise of relationship potential. He tried to hook her in with the invitation to go for a coffee, and the comment about her nail varnish was pure jailer. She said, "Thanks, darling, I love you too," walked off and rejoiced in the insight he had given her into who he really was. He is hoping the insight into the different abuser personas will help to keep you safe also. And now I'd like to open this teleclass up to your questions, comments, and thoughts. So if you'd like to unmute yourselves by pressing star 7, let's hear from you. So, since we have someone who's actually unmuted themselves. Oh dear. Is anybody going to speak up?
Hello, Helen's here.
Hi, Helen.
Hi there.
Hi. Speak, Helen. What would you like to share or ask?
Oh, I was just finding that very interesting, you know, and the overlaps, obviously. Mm. You know, the little pieces from the jailer and the king of the castle and the sexual controller. And, very, very useful, I think, group of personalities. Yes, it's all there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
And where does neglect come into it? Where does that fit? One who neglects.
That's an interesting one. I'm wondering how much it's the king of the castle.
Yeah.
Because he doesn't have to look after his slave, does he? But equally, the jailer.
Yes. Yes. Yeah, and controlling by threats, threats to withdraw, emotional intimacy missing, that sort of thing. So the sexual one, the jailer, but king of the castle for sure, absolutely king of the castle. Yes, I found it very useful.
Thank you. And the head worker as well, I think, because, you know, the fear of withdrawing affection or whatever, the neglect, that's a very big threat. That's a pretty violent threat.
Yes, yes, yes. I mean,
Sorry. It's passive-aggressive, and it sounds a bit innocent, and I presume he withdraws into this hurt, wronged person, but it's a very aggressive thing to do.
Yes, definitely the passive-aggressive and the withdrawing, and then saying things and then saying, oh, I would, you know, if you raise it another time, oh, I would never say a thing like that. I don't think like that. I can't remember even saying it.
Head worker.
So that's the head worker.
Yes, and I think the head worker was the most powerful one.
Yes.
The time I spent saying, but you said, no, I didn't.
That's the one. I get that a lot. But I don't even think like that. I wouldn't say a thing like that. You know, and you think, oh, crumbs, you know, I'm not stupid. I remember them.
Yeah.
And standing strong and saying, hang on, you know, that's not okay and that's not the truth. And, it's really quite challenging, I think, and exhausting.
It is exhausting, and the point comes, you know, when I think particularly the more you become aware of this, the more you can sort of just turn around and say, whatever, because you know you can never persuade him and it really isn't important to try.
Right, right.
But when you stop persuading him and you just say, whatever, that is really going to be quite unsettling.
Yes, yes, he doesn't like that.
Yes.
Yeah, because it's interesting. The overlaps are really, and it's so powerful. Just so powerful.
Yeah.
And to stay strong with you, to keep believing in yourself and your own thinking, your own way of thinking, and your own values and attitudes. It takes. You have to stay really focused to stay with it. Otherwise, you do question who the hell you are.
Yeah. And instead, you can start to have fun seeing who he is on a particular day. Head worker. I was blown away by this stuff. I did put out the Pat Craven interview, and which is well worth listening to if you haven't people. Mm-hmm. I can send the link again. Because Pat Craven.
Craven, is it? Pat Craven.
Yes, Craven.
Uh-huh.
Her book is Living with the Dominator.
Mm-hmm.
And she's very funny. I mean, she's been through the mill. She's dealt with some vile, vile abusers. And she's quite funny about them. You know, like the comment that if they don't have sex, their testicles will explode all over the carpet. And
yes.
Things like that.
Yes. Well, I really definitely some of that would have been part of my story, and you know, the right to have sex whenever you like, and a woman is that's her job.
Yeah.
That's her job, and if you don't get enough, well, of course a man can go elsewhere. You know, it's a man's right to go elsewhere.
Yeah.
And if you don't like, you know, trying to have a decent conversation about things, it's like, oh, well, if you don't like the way it is, I'll go home to mother, sort of thing. You know, I'll leave. You know, that withdrawal stuff, and like, you know, like a little boy's tantrum. But it's that threat of withdrawing stuff, and and being made to feel like you're a lesser person unless you just, you know, lay on your back whenever he wants to, and it's horrible.
Mm. Yeah. It is horrible, and it's, you know, it's an experience that should not have been happening in the late 20th century, and did.
No, that's right.
Yeah.
I guess it comes from those old generational thinking, too passed down, you know. I can see where he would have got it from his father and grandfather, you know, when I think about them.
Yes. And when you think about it, you know, there's also a lot of male chauvinism still ingrained in society, that all men, well, men can still have this attitude. It's still endorsed by part of the population, part of popular culture anyway.
Yes, exactly.
You know.
Yes.
Pat Craven's very strong on that.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, thank you.
Ladies, other ladies, what thoughts do we have? I know you're there.
How likely is it that someone can change with therapy and with help?
Who am I talking to?
This is Sarah from Denver.
Hi, Sarah. Well, Sarah, the chances are small, extremely small, and the person has really got to commit to their own change. And here's the thing, even if they do change, it doesn't mean that the two of you should be together.
Mm.
See, if a man wants to change, he should be prepared to do that change for his own reasons, because he's realized that he's a jerk and because he wants to do better. Now, my feeling is that if someone really wants to change and wants to do better, he should want to do better by you, whether he's with you or not. And he certainly should respect your wishes about where you want the relationship to go. That is, whether you wish it to disintegrate or not. I was having a conversation with a Russian relationship expert who's a friend of mine, Dr. Sasha Mitrofanov, recently. And we were talking about how a decent man runs a relationship. And he said, as Pat Craven also says, that if you're in a relationship with a decent guy and you say, look, I don't want to be with you anymore, a decent guy would say, well, you know, that breaks my heart and I'm really sorry about it, but if that's what you want, I will honor your request and I will also end the relationship in a respectful way. Now, that's got very, very little to do with what happens in an abusive relationship. And most times, when you say to an abuser, I've had enough, chum, you've got to leave now, I don't want any more of you, they suddenly realize the error of their ways, because it's inconvenient to lose a wife. So they will come out with the right things. They may, like my husband, agree to go to the therapist, make all the right noises, And normally at some point what creeps in is, I really want to make this change. I'm really committed to this change, but I need you to help me through it. I can't do it on my own. And that's abusive speak for, I'm going to suck you in, impress you with my good intentions, because you're always easily suckered, and basically, I'm not going to do the work because I can get you to do it for me. So I'm pretty cynical about abusive men changing, because if they don't change, which is the most likely outcome, you've lost time, you've lost energy, and you may well have lost faith in the world as well. And certainly, the police really dislike it when you call them out because of a violent partner and then say, no, I'm not going to press charges, or, no, no, we've got this one sorted out. Because it means that their intervention has been for nothing. And, you know, so not much hope, I would say. Does that help?
It does. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Would you have rather heard something different or not?
You know, I'm okay hearing it with where I am right now. It's taken me a long time to get to the place where I felt like I can't do this anymore, and I don't want my children learning this. I feel like I'm not being a role model for them that I want to be. And hearing that just backs up what I've already put into motion to divorce him and to go on with my life without him.
Yeah, and, you know, if by any chance the miracle occurs and he were to change, good. It's good, you know, that doesn't mean you should be with him.
No, it doesn't, and, it, you know, if nothing else, maybe he'd be a better father, because that's not really his strong suit either.
Yes. Of course not. The bad father routine. Yes. So
that was interesting hearing all your different descriptions. They all kind of mesh together to create my partner anyway.
Yes. So, you know, there is this thing that we've all essentially been married to the same man with small variations.
Mm-hmm.
Truly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yes, I was just going to say that I have a client who was married to a man who was most unpleasant. I mean, he was a real pig, he hit her, he was all the eight personas together. And she eventually called the police, threw him out, and then he had the change of heart. And he was quite wealthy, and she got a huge diamond out of it. And she had him back because a change of heart and a huge diamond sounds, you know, quite persuasive, let's face it. And things are just, the difference now is that he doesn't hit her, but she's as scared of him as she was, and the relationship is as empty and horrible as it was, and she's getting out slowly now. So that's the common things occur most commonly. And when you've got the strength to get out, that's the thing to do. More thoughts, comments, ladies?
Go ahead, go ahead.
I liked something you said at the beginning, which is something that got me into trouble, is that they don't think like us, they're not like us.
Yeah.
And I guess when I saw his behavior, I always assumed that he was hurting in some way, that he was in pain. But are they in pain?
Yeah. Well, it's one of those things that you almost don't need to know the answer to. Probably there is a lot of unresolved pain about something that happened to them in their life. Now, whether it was big or small doesn't really matter, because in the end it's how we all respond to the experiences that we have. So, I mean, my husband was convinced that he was in a lot of pain all the time. He also had more psychotherapy than most people in a lifetime, and he was still in pain. But whether they're in pain or not, that doesn't give them the right to inflict pain on you.
Yes, that's very true.
Yeah, it is. So, you know, we've been making excuses. Oh, he had a difficult childhood. Yeah, you might have done too.
Yes.
You know, and it's this crazy thing where we have a different standard for them. And we also believe that when they hurt us, they don't really mean to.
I did believe that.
Yeah, and the Pat Craven thing, they're not actually angry. We choose to believe that they lost control because they're angry, and when they're calm, that's the person who really means what they say. And it may not be the truth at all. You know, with my husband, because he's the abuser I know best, not because I wish to offload, he had a fantastic skill at finding really hurtful things to say. It was a superbly well-honed skill. And it's not unreasonable to suppose that he spent a fair bit of time thinking about the next hurtful thing he was going to say, because he's very creative.
Right. Did you say they weren't true, though, the things he said?
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, they're not... What's true anyway? They'll tell you you're fat, you're old, you're ugly, stupid, all this stuff. Well, that's not true.
Yeah.
Another person will tell you quite the opposite.
Yes.
And what they say is a lot more about their need to hurt than who you are. And if you're so terrible, why don't they just walk off and leave?
Yes, well, that was my biggest question.
Yeah.
Oh.
And there are various good reasons why they don't. One, because they've created quite a nice little nest for themselves. They've created this place where they can come home and behave as badly as they like, and you'll tolerate it.
Mm-hmm.
And it would be inconvenient. They'd have to train. They'd have to find someone else and train them up.
Mm-hmm.
Because another important point for me of the abuser is, and it came out very clearly from my ex-husband, who used to trot around when he was furious in his underpants and socks, stamping his foot. Not a pretty sight. But that was actually two-year-old temper tantrums.
Mm.
And if you think about it, they are incontinent of anger, and they're really having infantile temper tantrums, and they come up with infantile stuff like, nobody likes you, you know, which is playground stuff.
Yeah.
And in fact, being with you or me is their possibility to regress to their heart's content. Now, some of them like to go out and, you know, show off and be the big man with other women and, you know, do that stuff because it feels good. But that's a boy showing off. But being with you gives them the freedom to regress as much as they like in their own home. So they've got good reasons for staying, and then obviously financially it could be inconvenient to break up the family assets.
Sure.
So as far as I'm concerned, those are probably the best reasons for staying. They might tell you they love you intermittently, but you can't really set too much store by that because they don't behave in a loving way.
Right, it just didn't seem possible. Someone could love
no.
you. Yeah.
No. I mean, again, you know, I've reached the stage where I think maybe they love you as much as they choose to be capable of at the time.
Mm.
But, you know, supposing you had a dog which loved you but just bit you because it was vicious.
Oh.
How long would you keep that dog?
Yeah, not long.
Yeah. So, in a sense, we drive ourselves mad, I think, with these distinctions. Well, if he loves me, then maybe, you know, it's not so bad. Yes, it is. It's all awful. Do we have some more thoughts or comments?
Yes. What you're saying. Oh, sorry. Yep.
Okay, go ahead.
No, just very briefly. Interesting, it's just from what you were saying, it's like there's a chosen behaviour because they choose to behave so well out in public.
Yes.
And to other women, you know. So they can help exactly what they're doing. It's chosen. And, it means excuses aren't acceptable. Anyway, Annie, can I excuse myself? Unfortunately, I need to go. It's Helen.
Yes. Lovely to have you on the call and speak to you soon.
Okay. Thanks, Annie. Bye.
Take care. Bye. So, other ladies, any comments?
Yes, this is Virginia. I just wanted to ask a question, Annie. I've done a lot of reading, and of course I came across your materials, which have been very illuminating. But in the course of my reading, my question is, what are your thoughts on that perhaps across all of these eight personalities and any type of abusive man that we may run across, and I suppose women as well could apply, that we're dealing with essentially a pathological narcissist in all cases?
Well, I have to say that I incline towards Pat Craven's point of view, and she sort of says bollocksology. Because we can focus on the label, and I don't know what that gives you. Or you can just focus on the fact that these people can often be successful, functioning members of society who behave extraordinarily badly in their own home. And they choose their behaviors. I'm still stuck with this concept that they choose their behaviors.
Yes, why would anybody choose that kind of destructive behavior?
Because it works for them. It gives them what they want. Yes, they're damaged. They don't know how to really love. But then it's quite possible that you didn't either, and I didn't. That, you know, most of us who end up in abusive relationships, probably 99%, were not actually loved in a way that enabled us to grow as healthy, self-loving people. Is that true?
And that's so true. And it leads me to another question, which is, I've come to recognize that I was raised in a home where the father, my father, was one of these men, and my mother was the cowering victim. And I grew up with this, and his turning the rage on the children from time to time to displace it off of her. He knew that hitting a woman, his wife, was not socially acceptable. However, it was perfectly socially acceptable to beat one's children instead. And so I know the roots of it. My question is it possible for me as an individual female raised in this kind of an environment to transcend this at any point?
To transcend it,
rise above it, to choose another way, to remake myself so that this does not
Absolutely.
Look familiar and right to me, that it feels bad and wrong, and
well,
that
it
I
does
run
feel
from
bad
it.
And wrong.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. This is the thing, and I was just about to say that, you know, your abusive partner, abusive men are perhaps triggered by having grown up in a situation where they were devoid of healthy love. And we also largely grew up in situations where we were devoid of a healthy, loving background, and yet we do. Strive to give better love than we've ever known, and we give it to our children. And that is one proof that we actually are capable of healing and wholeness. And to me, it's the most amazing testimony to women's courage and strength of character that despite all of this, we will strive to love in a far better way than we've ever been loved.
Hmm.
And I think that's amazing.
Yes.
And it just gives you some indication of what we're capable of, what you're capable of. Does that help?
Yes, it does.
Yeah. There are no limits as far as I'm concerned. You can heal. It's very possible you can become whole. And, you know, that's what I'm passionate about helping women to do.
Thank you.
And that's where we're going with this. I'm not interested in just telling you about what you've been through. I'm interested in getting you to start finding this way to love yourself and dig deep into the resources that are within you. So one more thing I'd like to say, I'm doubtless say this a number of times because it's so exciting to me, and I hope it will be to you. And that is that I trained in the Alexander technique. I don't know if you know anything about it. Most people go, what? And that's fine too. And it's allegedly a sort of physical therapy. And the way it works is that it's people with back pain and stresses and physical discomfort usually find their way to the Alexander technique when everything else has failed and the doctor said, well, you've just got to learn to live with it. And when they get to the Alexander technique, they deal with a teacher who puts hands on them very gently and helps them to undo the muscular tensions that have kept them in that pain set. Because this is the bit that I find so thrilling. Everybody has, you know, everybody has the capacity to be healthy, to be comfortable in their body, and for their body to work well. There is native good use of the body. Let me get this right. The natural default state of our body is well-being. It's there, it's been hardwired into us, which is why when you see babies, they know how to get up and walk. They know how to crawl, they know how to walk. You don't sort of turn around to a three-month-old baby and say, come on, you've got your crawling lessons today, I'm going to spend 2 months teaching you how to crawl. They do it naturally. Yeah?
Yes.
Yeah. So that's been programmed into them. Now, what I believe, and it seems to work well, is that happiness and emotional well-being is our default state also. It is all the stresses and the strains and the hassles that have been visited on us and that we haven't known how to react to and get rid of that have led us to be unhappy and dysfunctional and fearful and all those other things that happen to us. It is experiences that we have not known how to process and get rid of. So what I'm passionate about is helping people to plow off those experiences, to get rid of those stresses and strains. Yes, you've had the experience. No, you don't have to live with all the accumulated stress of them forever after. It's about peeling off all those layers of stress and emotional tension so you can get back to emotional well-being. That's why I believe it's so doable. Does that make sense?
Yes. That it's innate within us. We just need to bring
yes.
it out.
Yeah. A lot of crap has been piled up over it over the years. We're just peeling off the crap so you can get back and discover what's really there under the pile of crap. Does that help?
Yes, yes, thank you.
Good. I hadn't actually meant to go into that tonight, but it did seem relevant. And what I do find on these courses is that as we go along, women do shed a lot of the crap that they've been carrying. And then they start to feel a lot better. Circumstances change as fast as they change, but the way you feel about yourself can change very quickly. It can change for the better. So, we've come virtually to the end of tonight's call. What I will do is I will post it on the website in the next day or so, as soon as I have a chance, which tomorrow is not going to be very likely, because I'm not near the computer. But what's been the most useful thing for all of you in tonight's call? Nobody leaves till we get an answer. I'm glad you laughed. I was worried you might think I was being silly.
I think the bit about Simon was, and the lava and the eruption and the cycles was very illuminating to me, to see that this person's programmed to do this, and it doesn't matter if I'm the object or another woman is the object or another woman is the object. He's just needing an object.
Yeah.
To do this cycle in front of. As sort of an audience. An audience, a target, if you will. And it was very freeing because it's not personal. It's not about
me.
No,
it's not actually. No, you just happen to be the person in front of him.
Right.
Excellent. Other thoughts? I love this. In the classroom, you'd see people sitting with their eyes down. No, 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 don't ask me, please. If you can chuckle, I'm sure you can. Let's share what's been the most useful thing for you for tonight.
Well, I like this being able to ask you questions directly. I think that helps. Just because a lot of the questions are similar, but you think they're not, but it's just good to get an answer.
Yeah.
And a lot of just bother, they stick in my head, and just it really does help.
Yeah. I understand.
I liked hearing about seeing your husband, your ex-husband with your daughter and the mask, and hearing about that changing, because I've seen that in my own experiences, and it's unbelievable how they can change on a dime when there's a social situation versus if it's just you, or the social situation where you're at the party and you know you're going to get it later.
Yeah.
It's good to be validated on that, though.
Yes. And, you know, it's so calculating, isn't it, that they can do that?
Unreal to me.
Yeah.
That you could treat someone like that. Yeah. And like it.
Mm.
Yes. Well, that's them.
Mm-hmm. It
is. Do we have anybody else who hasn't spoken? Who do we have who hasn't spoken? Maybe we don't. Okay. Well, it's been really great speaking with you tonight. I shall look forward to next week's call. And any questions or thoughts, just send me an email and I'll put the recording up on the website. And also a link to the interview with Pat Craven, because if you haven't listened to it, it's well worth listening to. So thank you for being here tonight, and I look forward to speaking to you next week.
Thank you.
Bye now.
Same here. Thank you, Annie.
Thank you, Annie.
Good night. Bye.
Good night.
Bye-bye.